Hey guys, welcome back. Here we're going to deliver you guys our second part of our episode on sustainability. So we just took a short break, and last you heard from us, we were discussing sustainability in terms of automobiles and the challenges with that is moving your waste from one place to another and how complex this issue is. And in this one, what we're going to do is we're going to orient you a little bit more towards the local in our place, Austria. And we're also going to discuss sustainability in some more STS theories and how some of our colleagues in the field of STS have dealt with this and related topics.
Yes, talking about STS, do you remember that in our last episode we spoke about slow disasters and fast disasters?
Yes.
We do. I do remember.
vaguely, I do. Yeah. My memory is also slow.
Glad your brains are still working after the long holidays. But what got me thinking is it's interesting because in fashion there is also those terms, slow fashion and fast fashion, and they have a lot to do with secondhand shopping and shopping from very big retailers and how unsustainable this could be because, you know, 85% of all textiles go to dump each year anyways. So I thought it would be quite interesting to actually hear a perspective on that because it's probably not a very strongly accepted idea to go for secondhand shops, for example. But Ivana Dimitrova, a friend of mine from Bulgaria who studied in London for a few years, she's really a big fan and she actually made even an exchange collective society here in Bulgaria. So let's see what she has to share us about slow fashion.
Hey everyone, hey Robbie, thanks for thinking of me when thinking of slow fashion. It actually means so much because I've been part of the slow fashion movement for just over 2 years now, but I have been a secondhand shopper for over a decade. To start with some context, slow fashion for me is everything and anything that is secondhand, you've exchanged with a friend, or comes from a local producer slash one with a very transparent supply chain. Fast fashion, on the other hand, is usually very seasonal, trend-driven, and has a super short lifespan. It's what we see in large retailer chains where we don't know who made it or where the materials are coming from. But it does go deeper than that as well. Fast fashion has a huge social impact. From poor working conditions in garment production to questionable values and negative mental health impact, it's pretty detrimental to all of us as well as our planet. When it comes to practicing slow fashion, however, things are not always as easy. I'm very lucky to be living in Bulgaria now, where secondhand shopping is popular and affordable. But back in the day, when living in London, secondhand shopping was not something I could afford. Everything was labeled vintage and three times the price. Plus, smaller and local fashion brands are usually more expensive, which is natural. Sustainable fashion production is not cheap. So it's no surprise that not all of us can afford to take the full slow fashion route. But you can build slow fashion-like shopping habits even if you can't afford what is considered slow fashion. One example of that would be building a wardrobe of timeless pieces you love. This way, you can shop less and just have versatile clothes you can use for longer. It's not an easy task, I admit, because it's kind of like finding yourself, but it's worth it. Care is another area you can take a look at. Are you caring properly for your garments and can you make them live longer than they were made to? This is one way to really minimize buying clothes. Of course, if you're lucky enough to have affordable secondhand fashion near, take advantage. Secondhand shopping has allowed me to experiment with my style so much in order to find it and know better what works for me. So then I can build this wardrobe of versatile pieces that I can use longer and love for longer. So yes, I'd say slow fashion, or at least the slow fashion sentiment, is accessible to almost all of us. And if you still think slow fashion isn't for you, I strongly encourage you to try at least a bit of it this year. You know, maybe exchange some items with your friends or pop into a secondhand shop or a local fashion brand. See what happens, just for the laughs. And who knows, you might just enjoy it. I know I have.
That is inspiring, what she's saying. Thank you so much for sending us this great quote and also encouraging us and our listeners to try it out and be aware of your fashion consumerism and
Yeah, you know, it's actually very true what she mentioned, and it's something we briefly touched upon earlier, buying local. And it also applies for fashion, not only for apples. So that's how you give small brands the opportunity to grow. And I think very quickly, before we finish with the topic of fashion, because I know, guys, you're probably not big fans of it. We always give the Netherlands and the particular regions that are more sustainability developed as example. So the problem is not the production that much, but the consumerism model, and this one should be changed. So there is this lady, Viga Svensson, she's called, if I pronounce it properly. She created a Danish company that's actually an award-winning circular design brand for kids and maternity wear. And the thing is that you buy something like a membership, and you don't just buy separate pieces, but you simply exchange the same pieces with multiple people. And the clothes are then delivered to the customer in the circular concept. And the result is that clothes are used by 5 to 10 people, depending on how they're cared. So a lot of people believe that's kind of the new consumerism models, a more sustainable fashion model as a whole. Have you ever bought something from a secondhand?
Yeah, check it out. There's great stuff out there. What I used to do a lot is going to my grandpa's house and checking out his wardrobe, and he had an amazing style and still has an amazing style. So I really love to wear his sweaters and shirts, and yeah, just they last forever. Like, I have been wearing them for years already, and they don't wear out.
We are proud of you, Costa.
Yeah, we're proud of you.
Thanks. I had many bad examples today that I finally got a positive one.
Yeah, I'm very proud of you, Costa. I also, now it makes sense the way that you dress. No, I'm just kidding. I'm sure you're kidding. No, it makes sense because you're so excellent. You're so excellently styled. What I really liked about this example that was sent in to us is she kind of answered all of my critiques that I usually have when people talk about sustainability in fashion, where I think, okay, yes, who can really afford this type of stuff? And, you know, she answered almost everything. There's so many things you can do as an individual in fashion. And I think you might think we want to get off of this topic of fashion, but I think it's a really good launching point to discuss this individual responsibility, where we can all make certain decisions. And it's not so hard. It just takes a little bit more effort and a little bit more time to look in. And if you do it right, you can actually save some money.
That is true. That is true. Still, I really want to point out that there is some inequality in terms of the climate crisis. I read two reports by Oxfam from 2015 and 2020, and they say that the poorest half of the global population, that is around 3.5 billion people, they are only responsible for around 10% of total global emissions. When it comes to individual consumption, we're mostly talking about individual consumption. And yet they live overwhelmingly in the countries with the most that are most vulnerable to climate change. So this is another type of inequality. So they don't really put a lot of global emissions up there, but they are affected by climate change a lot, which we can see all around the globe in the global south. And when we look at the other side of the coin, around 50% of the emissions, of the worldwide emissions, can be attributed to the 10%, like the richest 10% of people around the globe. So yeah, there is some inequality there, and individual carbon emissions are highly unequally distributed throughout the world. And sorry if I left you with no words now, but I think this is really, really problematic.
It is. And it's amazing that you're bringing up also other aspects of inequality, because we sometimes kind of stay only within the stuff we know about and we don't consider so much stuff. Like here we worry about what kind of engine and what kind of battery we have, and other people barely find pure water to drink. And who cares where the apples are from when you don't have anything to eat? So in terms of racism, in terms of ethnical, you know, offenses and stuff, that's a big aspect of sustainability and social aspects, I think. And I'm glad that here in Austria, people were, at least in Vienna, because I wouldn't be able to speak about the whole country, of course, but at least in Vienna, people were very open-minded. Also in the business, they're trying to incorporate this corporate social responsibility, SCR, to kind of contribute to particular social goals, and more philanthropic, more activist-related, more engaged, ethnically-oriented practices and so on. So hands up for Austria and for Vienna.
So you think the situation in terms of sustainability is quite okay in, or quite good actually, in Vienna and Austria?
Oh yeah, for sure. For sure, there is like an endless list of startups, for example, that make so cool stuff like Too Good To Go. You probably know it already.
That I know.
Yes. So you don't waste food, basically. You have Refurbed, which reduces e-plastics. You have Rebel Meat that make meat out of shrooms. You have
mushrooms.
Öklo. Yeah, mushrooms. Sorry.
Just so the listeners are clear.
Oops. Yeah, you have Zirp Insect that they make insects, basically. You can have them for breakfast with your muesli. And there's so many cool and innovative stuff that, you know, Austria is really ahead of other countries in Europe in terms of sustainable solutions. So yeah, a lot of zero waste shops also in Austria, in Vienna in particular. Damned plastic in Salzburg. There are a lot.
I see. So there's a lot going on in Austria. And I think this is really cool, like the stuff you're mentioning. Like there's really innovative stuff that is happening. But still, I think like Austria, I read one statistic that said that Austria, in terms of the mobility, is doing really bad, for instance, like that, like most of the people are still using cars, of course. And there's a lot of traffic going on in Austria also.
So by mobility, you mean transportation, right?
Exactly, transportation.
Yeah.
That's actually not true, because the Austrian public transport, they achieved their climate goal for 2020. And actually, there is a magazine, Tech and Nature, it's called. It produces a lot of local content that is dedicated particularly on sustainability in Austria. So you guys can go check it out. And I think it's very interesting, and it kind of reminds me of something else. You know, in our previous episodes, we always talk about measuring stuff. How do you measure culture? How do you measure this? How do you measure consumption? And now I'm asking you, how the hell do you measure sustainability?
It's as difficult as the last times, I think. What do you think, Harry?
I think it's as difficult, if not more difficult, and it's something we discussed in the last segment about the sustainability topic, is there's all sorts of ways to measure it, but there's not one way to measure all of it, right? That there's, like as Costa said, this entire topic is littered with inequality. So I think the further you stretch the scope, the less and less measurable it is. So you can compare different countries, and maybe on one, like if you're talking about sustainable goals, even if they're just for Austria, maybe they're met in Austria. But once they're met, does that mean that they're met? Or does that mean, like, is that the best that it could be? Or could it be better? Right? Like, I think it's a feel good thing to have met these goals. I'm not trying to say, yeah, whatever, they met the goals. I think it's a great thing that they met the goals, but I think that the standards we set, that certain measurements are put forward to meet them, right? We don't set goals not to meet them. We set goals and that can be met, right? They're based on projections. They're based on modeling. So the world around us has been scientized in a way that you can have these metrics. And what would be the point of having a bunch of goals that you don't meet? So I think it's not necessarily surprising that Austria meets all the goals to me, because Austria tends to do that in most respects when they set out their own goals. It's just, I don't know, as an outsider living in Vienna, it's one of the things I see quite a lot, is it's for such a critiquing type of environment that you get for the stereotype of Austria and especially Vienna, they're pretty optimistic in how they seem to navigate the world and what they're able to accomplish. And even the entrepreneurial kind of spirit in this city itself, you know, of all the solutions with sustainability and everything, I don't think we've discussed one that isn't a corporate or at least a startup or something that's not an economic type of unit. So selling a replacement product, it hasn't seemed to me that there's so many systematic or explicitly political type things, but they're almost all in the consumer market, where it's individuals utilizing these things that are more sustainable and less on a systematic point of view.
I totally agree with you. And actually, I had some points, but now I cannot say anything because you're so right. Because when I meant how we measure sustainability, I was thinking about how many awards there are in Austria about sustainability. You have the Sustainability Award by the Federal Ministry of Education, Science and Research. Then you have the Austrian SDG Award. Then you have the TUN Award by Magenta. And all of them are supporting sustainable innovative projects. But it's true. All of them are somehow connected to the corporate and the business world. And the only thing that comes on my mind that is not is this practices of the city of Wien, Stadt Wien, like city of Vienna, that they really, really try to support urban gardening. Yep. So there are particular places around Vienna where you can go and plant your own tomatoes. And also the Technical University, I don't know if you guys know, but they are having beehives on top of some of their roofs. Simply because, you know, this colony collapse disorder that's happening, or I don't know how exactly it was called, where bees are dying. It's an issue. So the Technical University decided to do something about it. But they're producing honey dough.
So. That sounds great.
Yeah, I kind of want to circle back around, and while maybe we can discuss it in the vein of Vienna and everything, and discussing inequality, because I've always had this big grandpa gripe with the sustainability in a nutshell. Personally, I come from, like, I think you can describe it as a lower, definitely working class background. Like, I'm the first person in my family to even go to get a degree. And sustainability wasn't really a word around my household because it just didn't make any sense. Like, we didn't have time for it and it wasn't the biggest concern for us. And I've always had this kind of negative feeling, which doesn't make me feel great, that sustainability should be for everybody, but that it's not for everybody, at least the way that it appears everywhere. Like, who can really afford, with the way it appears now to everyday folks or lay people, as STS scholars describe them, who can be sustainable and who is sustainability for? And I know Constantine and I have had some really informal discussions about this with a few alcoholic beverages, but maybe Constantine, you can just go off the cuff here. And what are your feelings, especially in as it pertains to Austrians and Vienna?
I mean, what comes to my mind immediately is that it's crucial that the size of ecological footprint strongly correlates with income. So you're totally right. Who can afford some stuff, some sustainable stuff and stuff in general is important. And you mentioned another great point, which is distinction. Like, for upper and upper middle classes, Pierre Bourdieu developed a French sociologist developed the term habitus for all people. Like, you have a certain, your entire appearance, like your lifestyle, language, clothing, and taste is usually class or milieu specific. And so you have certain lifestyles, certain consumption patterns. And for upper and upper middle class, this is usually also connected to distinction. Like they want to distinct themselves from lower or middle classes. And like nowadays, as you mentioned, it is a buzzword it is en vogue, so to say, to be sustainable, which some people can definitely afford and some cannot. And this really connects well with another concept that Ulrich Brandt and Markus Wissen developed in 2017. Ulrich Brandt is actually a Viennese professor for political science, for international politics. And they together developed the concept of the imperial way of life. This sounds a little bit, I think it sounds terrific and a little bit frightening, but the definition is the imperial way of life refers to production, distribution, and consumption norms that are deeply embedded in the political, economic, and cultural structures and practices of populations in the global north, and increasingly also in the emerging economies in the global south. So this means that these embedded practices and structures are nowadays not only inherent to life and what is going on in the global north, so US, Europe, and so forth, but also in emerging economies like we have discussed in the first part, like China, India, Brazil, and so forth. And these everyday extensive access, like these consumption and distribution norms mean everyday extensive access to global labor assets and nature also, in terms and via the world market. So it is indeed an imperial way of life because it's an exclusive production and it permanently uses an external. So Stefan Lessenich, for example, talks about the externalization society. And I think like this concept really, really is interesting to me, the imperial way of life, because it shows how deeply embedded it is in our everyday lives and how problematic it is also in terms of sustainability, which is really hard to reach in that regard. What do you think about this concept, or what comes to your mind when you hear that?
Well, the imperial way of life is less off the cuff than I imagined, but thank you for your remarks.
Oof, I would say that I'm surprised how researched actually the topic of sustainability is, even if it's not really consciously sustainability, because as social scientists, we understand how many factors there are. So you spoke earlier about how in your family, Harry, the topic of sustainability was not really something you talked about. Well, I tell you, I heard the word sustainability for the first time a few years ago when I was already living abroad. But I realized that my culture is very sustainable, even if they don't know about it. Mm-hmm. Simply because these regions here, the Balkans, they didn't have financial, freedom for many, many years. So they had to learn to make something out of nothing and repair stuff and reuse them multiple times. So that's something that I got reminded about when Costa said what he said, is that people consciously or subconsciously are somehow program to be more sustainably living or not. And I don't know, I think it's very interesting, and all the findings that Costa stumbled upon are just whoa.
It's a fantastic point, Robbie. Like it's kind of what I was saying is, I think also my family, like, shit, we didn't know we were sustainable, but maybe we were just poor and therefore we were sustainable, right? Like if you don't have the money, it's much easier to be sustainable in some type of way because you have no alternative. So if you don't know the word, it doesn't mean you're not sustainable.
Exactly. You're so right. That is one of the major points that Ulrich Brandt and Markus Wissen, what they make, is indeed that people it depends on the income of the people, how sustainable they actually are and how high the footprint is. And even if you don't know about sustainability at all, it might occur that you are kind of living sustainable. And in the end, what comes to my mind is that we always, like in northern, in the global north societies, we always say, okay, yeah, we are so sustainable. We are so aware of the climate crisis and we are so aware of these issues. But still, in the end, people in the global south, they might be not as aware as we are, but indeed they are not contributing to the problems as much as we are. And yeah, this is really a difficult issue to me, because yeah, people think they are so smart and they're so good and so good to the environment and blah blah blah, but in the end, yeah, it's kind of a misconception also sometimes.
Yeah, do you know what now I remember about something I read a while ago? It's a professor, his name is Klaus Lamm, I just looked it up. He's a professor of biological psychology and he's head of the social and cognitive and affective neuroscience at University of Vienna in the Faculty of Psychology. So he actually makes a lot of research about social cognition and behavior of people. And he studied also the psychology behind understanding climate crisis and sustainability. And something very interesting he points out in one interview, again in the Tech and Nature magazine, is exactly the social norms of what is considered successful. And he speaks about how people who are like going on a trip to the Seychelles with a very expensive plane and stuff like that, people usually look at them and say, he made it or she made it. So that's kind of the standard and the norm you're looking up to. So if those norms change in, okay, look at this person, he actually managed to make this ultra sustainable trip, maybe that's when things are going to start changing. And he introduces his climate protection diet, which is not exactly what it sounds like. It has nothing to do with eating, but more like the psychological aspect of it. So if you're interested, you can look it up. We're gonna link it in our description.
Yeah, it's a great point, and it links onto a lot of what I want to say, and particularly what the STS scholar that many people know about, Sheila Jasnov, when thinking about constitutionalism, which a big part of that is to establish normatives in the way that we live our life, which really is just a question and activity of value setting. And what do we prioritize and what do we want from life and where do we look to establish those things that we want and establish those things that we want to normatize or make normal. And I think something that we've kind of discussed on that I think we glance over a lot of the time is, you know, people, I don't think it's necessarily true that people have to know all about sustainability and every citizen has to be super informed about everything in order to correct the situation we're on. Nor do I think that's a super realistic thing to expect individuals to take on the responsibility of knowing their place in the world and knowing what it is that they have to do as an individual to remedy the situation, especially if they're almost not responsible at all in the grand scheme of things to the problems that we face. And I think in 2000, she discussed what our situation was in this constitution making at the millennium. And now 20 years after that, she had the great question of when is the collective knowledge enough to warrant collective action? And I think with climate change, global warming, what have you, I think enough of us know now, and I hopefully realize that we have enough knowledge and that we need to start and set the gears in motion more than they've already been done. I think the Paris Agreement is... While it's nice that nations came together to set these goals, almost all the best experts in the world say that it's just absolutely not enough and it's just barely scratching at the surface. It won't even dent it. Like it's almost an insult to the planet that we live on. And in that sense, that we need to shift our efforts to individuals knowing enough to correct their individual behaviors to more systematic types of upheavals or alterations to our behaviors to set new normatives and to imagine new futures in a way that sets it in the constitutional frame, like the parameters of living. Because the parameters of living that we have now, even if we all have electric cars, it as we've illustrated in the last episode, is not going to make the difference we need to upend the damage we're doing.
You're so true. And Jazanov, she's simply the queen of STS. I sometimes
for better
wonder
and worse.
I don't know how complicated her brain works. Every time I read or hear something from her, I'm just, whoa. But, you know, I think we have discussed earlier that 99% of the scientists agree on climate change and stuff like that. But there are still so many conspiracy theories. And another STS aspect we could apply to it is exactly the knowledge production practices, which is something that Jazanov, I think, also has to do with. So how do you define what knowledge is actually accurate? And it's so hard nowadays, especially there's so much content on the internet and on social media, so many fake news. And I think at some point people were overloaded with information. So the knowledge really stays somewhere aside. I don't know how to decide it, to describe it, this difference between actual knowledge and simply factology that doesn't necessarily is accurate.
But Robbie, do you think that that distinction is totally, I know it's important, but do you think it's the most important thing to separate? These are the facts at hand. This is scientifically derived knowledge, and this stuff is not. Because I think one of the things that Jazanov really tries to get at is that it is making what she calls durable representations. So representations and knowledge that lasts, because scientific facts change. And so one of the challenge with communicating climate change, and also, I guess, in that sense, communicating what it means to live sustainable, is setting a representation that will last over time with changing facts. So, and she's quite clear and quite explicit that these things cannot come from scientific activity alone, but that they have to come from normative and cultural understandings as of the world as it ought to be, not as it is, but as it ought to be. So that sounds easier said than done. As often I'm left with Jazanov text, I think, wow. And then I think, well, how? Yeah, I think, wow. And then I think, how? Because, and that's, I think that's the brilliance of her mind is that sometimes she's so ahead of it that it doesn't necessarily make sense when you first look at it. But then you're just left with more and more and more questions, like Pandora's box. So I don't know if there's a response to be had with what I just said, but I'd be happy to hear your thoughts, Robbie.
All right, I go first. Sorry. Jazanov, wait, what was it that I wanted to say? Yeah, you mentioned that, facts, scientific facts change. And it got me thinking that we often talk about how there are, different scientific beliefs that got established simply because the bigger part of scientists believe in it. So this creates even more controversy in the whole discussion. And I think climate change and sustainability could be applied very well as an example. So I have no really remarks to Jazanov. I would never dare, but maybe Kolsa has something to say.
About Jazanov, no, that's okay.
That's awesome. I'm way less intimidating than Jazanov. So, what I was going to say is that we live it like one of the bewildering things about our modern society is I think we've reached this point where it's so cool and hip to make things as exact as possible and to have all these measurables. So in our episodes, we've discussed measurability. when I think it's almost, it's not necessarily so challenging to be so precise anymore. The more challenging thing is to put things in a form that can be communicated across various cultures and various languages and various understandings. And that seems to be the challenge we're up against, because we can make things as specific as possible, and scientists can make things as specific as possible with modeling and forecast. And I don't think that necessarily is doing the right thing to communicate to people, when it's almost as it, to me, the better thing would be to not necessarily simplify it, but just put it in purely explicit terms, right? I don't know.
I also don't know.
Okay, I also don't know, but I do know something else, which is, and it actually ties in with what you told us about Sheila Jasanoff and her work, because I stumbled upon a term which is environmental justice. And this actually stands for a frame for understanding inequity with respect to the environment, which includes distribution of hazards, participation and decision-making around it, and the recognition of both cultural identity and the unique knowledge of marginalized groups. So that does tie in a little bit with what you told us, because different cultures, of course, develop different types of knowledge. And therefore, we need to understand and be aware of these different situated knowledges, as Donna Haraway put it once. And this environmental justice term actually comes into action when situations occur where environmental burdens fall heavily on a group that is already structurally marginalized by virtues of race, gender, class, or rurality, for instance. And this obviously has a global north, global south dimension, and we can see it really. But what is crucial here, that what we have been discussing now in terms of STS spins we put to the topic, that it is always contests over knowledge. So what do you know about the pollution that has been there or is there? What do you know about the health hazards and so forth? And therefore, actually, what could STS do then is the question. How could STS be dealing with this problem? And actually, STS approaches could usefully reveal how worldwide flow of knowledge happens, how expertise is distributed, and how technology structures environmental injustices. And it is a big task, of course, for STS. It's not the biggest field in all of the disciplines, but maybe we can see how this will develop further.
What you're saying, just only one thing's come on my mind, and it is the more you know, the less you understand. I don't know
right.
Who said that, but it just perfectly fits the situation. The more you learn, the more you read, you realize that there is so much more stuff that you could know in order to actually have this objective opinion or expert opinion. So knowledge never ends, never ends. We cannot catch up with it. Neither Jasanoff can.
No, of course not. But I think it is crucial that the social sciences, and we are social scientists or students at least, and also STS, Science, Technology and Society, students and scholars, that they in general have a crucial role in explaining the causes and consequences of global environmental change, and informing more effective, equitable, and durable solutions also to today's sustainability challenges. And I think, like, as social scientists, we should try to communicate this issue properly and make the world better.
This is a hot and uninformed opinion of mine, but I think it's okay. I think one of the traps that we should avoid in the future is, even though we want to make the communication of these issues easier, more widespread, the trap is to not use buzzwords and phrases and things, or to at least have different ways to explain them or to start to unpack them. Are you guys familiar with the concept of plastic words, for instance?
Not at all.
No, explain it, please.
Yeah, so I will butcher his name, but it's 30 years old or so, but it's Uwe Purksen. I think he's a sociologist, but I'm not sure. Anyways, what he discusses these words that the words where their origins can no longer be discerned, or words where they've used so much and brought so much into the foy that you no longer know what they mean anymore. And it's in an STS way of thinking, it's almost that the word becomes black boxed, so that you just bring up this word and that's where it ends. Without any more explanation or going into any more detail about it, that's where the conversation stops. So it's almost as if the word is a conversation stopper. And to quote him directly, you know, it's when these words, they come in, they almost invade your private conversations. So they're not just used in corporate life, but they're also used in your private life. And when they first appear, they're fashionable, right? They demand the attention of people. So sustainability, for example, when it first came into being, I'm sure it was a crazy revolutionary word, and we can still see it. I think it hasn't necessarily, it's just about peaked to me with sustainability, because you see all big brands using it. You see it in everyday life. But then after a while, what he describes is this process of them merging with everyday, which is what you see now. And they soon seem common sense. So living sustainability isn't exceptional anymore. It's almost a norm. And I think what it does is damaging in some sort of sense, in that, like I said, we just stop there. So if a product is sustainable, the conversation is ended. And I think that's a huge problem of communication. So we should really avoid the trap of just coming up with buzzwords that are easy to stamp on something, whether it be a product or a process, and start to move towards being able to communicate things in a way that doesn't rely on those types of things.
So this is where we are going to hold on. Stop for a moment and actually think if what we were talking until now makes sense, because we use a lot of buzzwords. And we could talk about sustainability also in another third episode, because there are so many stuff we would like to share. But it's time to close this episode. And big part of the information I particularly used in it is from the Tech and Nature magazine. So I want to introduce you Katarina, part of the Tech and Nature magazine and team, who summarizes very nicely the concept of sustainability and introduces us better to this local magazine that we could learn so much from.
I think sustainability is quite a holistic concept, and I think way too often it's used just in an environmental view, but in the end, it's not only the environmental view, it's the social and also the economic view. And I think that's an important thing we always need to take into account. And also, I think it's not only about what individuals do or only what the politics is doing, but it's like an all-rounder thingy, you know. We as individuals need to start somewhere and start consuming differently, because how we consume in the Western world, at least now, is just not sustainable. So we definitely need to overthink this. But also companies need to start producing more sustainable, and just some products need to be taken out of supermarkets and so on, because they are just not sustainable in any way. Or you need to find alternatives. And same, politics need to start moving regulations and so on, so that some things are just not possible anymore, or to push it in the right way, like renewable energy and so on, to make subsidies there so it's more affordable and more accessible. What we do at Tech and Nature is to show innovative solutions for many of those challenges in a social way, but also in an environmental way. So we showcase startups, but also bigger companies and their solutions to the climate crisis, but also to different social problems in our society. So this can be new business models or renewed business models or alternative products and so on. And sometimes we also show the progress in the politics. So if there are new regulations towards the climate or anything else, basically. So we really want to showcase the new ways of living, basically, or producing and so on. So we also want to support companies in their sustainability communication in the end. So people know what's going on, basically.
I think it wrapped it up pretty nicely.
Yeah, it wrapped it up pretty nicely.
Thank you to Katharina for sending in this really nice clip. I think it's a great place to end here, because what she illustrates here is that we should really think about sustainability as a holistic thing and not just one thing or another. And it helps avoid the trap of it being a buzzword. And, you know, guys, we could talk all day about this topic, and we've had a lot of fun here and some nice debates. And I think we've resolved some inner quarrels between group members with our optimistic and negative Nancy type tendencies. But if you want to hear us talk more about sustainability or climate change / global warming or anything else related to this topic, we encourage you to write to us at scienceslotmachine@gmail.com, tweet at us, or simply message us on Instagram. Any way that you'd like, we'd be happy to hear from you. And we always really encourage feedback from our listeners on what we can discuss the next episode. So from Robbie, Costa, and me, we're signing out here this week, and we look forward to joining you next time.
Bye.
Bye.